So, we're going to be in Daniel. Woo-wee! We're going to be in Daniel chapter 7 today. So, if you want to grab a Bible, they're on these corner chairs. I would highly, highly recommend a Bible today. It's Daniel's about two-thirds the way through the Bible. You've got the three major prophets of the Old Testament. You've got Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then you've got the writings of Daniel. I think it's page 619 in those blue Bibles if you're looking for it. Heads up, Daniel's a wacky book. There's no way around it. Daniel is a wacky book, and we are going to be engaging, reflecting on one of its wackier chapters, Daniel chapter 7. This week, we're going to be talking about, we're changing our plans just a little bit. I know, we're changing plans, whatever. We're going to be talking about that little bit in the creed right there of Jesus has ascended, rose again, he's ascended into heaven, he's seated at the right hand of God the Father, and he will come to judge the living and the dead. I planned on talking about that next week, is actually what I'd planned on doing, and I planned on talking about the church and us a little this week. But the more I reflected on it, the more I prayed about it, I realized that the way that we understand the future gives radical shape to the way that we live in the present. I think there's all kinds of wisdom in the creed having judged the living and the dead before it moves into anything about us and what we are doing in the present and the work of the Holy Spirit. So, because in the seasons of my life where things feel like they're spinning out of... Or is anyone with me on this? Like, the seasons of my life where I feel like things are just spinning out of control, where things are a little, like, darkened, where I don't quite know what... can't see in front of me. It's like there's a veil or a mist or a fog or something. I don't know what's coming. Man, those are the seasons of my life where I feel like I am just like, I'm really likely to slip into despair. I could slip into darkness. I can slip into destructive habits very, very easily during those seasons of life. When the future seems dark, the present's dark. You know what I mean? And the opposite's true, too. Like, when you kind of know, when you get test results back and it's like, oh, whew, it's not cancer, you know, all of a sudden, like, the future gets bright a little bit. And even though, like, you might be struggling in the present, you know, the present might be painful, the present might be hard, it might feel chaotic right now, when I can see hope in the future, all of a sudden, I find hope in the present. You know what I mean? That's the way that we understand the future radically shapes the way that we live in the present. And I think that's why the creed's pointing towards the future before it talks about us. The creed's pointing towards like the ultimate future before it starts talking about us right now in the present. I think that we learn to become the church as we begin to confess the future. So that's why we're changing up our plans a little bit. And so we're going to be talking about the future judgment this week. Oh, man, it's something that, C.S. Lewis has this line about it's about demons. And he's like, you're in danger two ways with demons. You're in danger of thinking too much about them, and you're in danger of not believing in their existence, is what C.S. Lewis says. I think that's the same with the final judgment. It's very rare to find a church. It seems like there are churches that talk about the final judgment and the coming of like what's happening in the future. They talk about it a lot, and they write books about it and whatever. Or there are churches that don't think about it at all. Hopefully we can thread the needle and think about it biblically today. So we're going to be talking about the future judgment today, and then next week we'll be talking about the church. We'll be finishing up our conversation on the creed. Sound like a plan? Yes? Yes. We're all good. So, we've arrived at a point in the creed that doesn't quite sound like good news. I don't know like how many of you, as you're reciting the creed, you feel like, he will come to judge the living and the dead. It's got this kind of like, oh man, this has got kind of a scary edge to it or something like that. It doesn't quite sound like good news. Each week we've been saying that that this is good news, and that the good news is about God. It's about what God is like, about what God does, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But judgment, He will come to judge the living and the dead. That doesn't quite sound like good news, does it? Judgment. Jesus will come. How is judgment a good thing? Is a question. How is judgment good news? How is judgment gospel? That's a really good question. Listen to the way we started by reading Psalm, I think, 96. Listen to the way that the psalmist, this is two psalms, this isn't the same psalm, this is another psalm. Psalm 98 describes God's judgment. This is Psalm 98, verse 7, if you're curious. Let the sea resound and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. Let the rivers clap their hands. Let the mountains sing together for joy. Let them sing before the Lord. Why? For he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples with equity. The psalmist is looking forward to the day when God's going to judge the world. That's when we're confessing that Jesus will come to judge the living and the dead, I'm wanting us to tap into what the heart of the psalmist here, that God's judgment is a good thing. We need some, but how many of us look at like what's going on in the world and we're like, good grief, so we need somebody to sort this out. We need like a judge to sort out the world. That's what the psalmist is saying. It's a good thing. A day when, you know, the rivers are going to like break into applause. A day when the mountains are going to burst into song. That's the kind of day we're wanting to tap into. And Daniel 7 is like, oh man, it's like one of the most famous passages about judgment in the entire Bible. And it's thick, it's dense. Get ready. But it's really important because almost the entire way that the New Testament thinks about judgment is being shaped by Daniel chapter 7. So much of it. So let's just go ahead and read it. Enough anticipation, let's go. Daniel chapter 7, starting in verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. And visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the other, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had wings of an eagle. I watched until the wings were torn off, and it was lifted up from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes, like the eyes of a human being, and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch. Because of the boastful words of the horn, because of the boastful words the horn was speaking, I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but they were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Verse 15, I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. Yeah, no doubt. Like a lot of dreams, this one's a little wild. It's a little psychedelic. It's a little trippy almost. You kind of wonder what Daniel ate before he went to sleep that night. Maybe extra mushrooms on the pizza wasn't a good idea. You know, what kind of mushrooms were those? What is this all about? What is that? Thankfully, we have a little bit of direction. We're not going to read it, but like later in the chapter, we get a little bit of direction from the text itself on how to understand all of this wackiness. Because let's read verse 16. Daniel walks up to somebody, presumably someone before the Ancient of Days, you know, those 10,000 times 10,000. He's like, hey, what's all of this about? Is what he asks in verse 16. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. And so he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kings that will rise from the earth, but the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. We'll stop there. Whew! Okay, we made it through 18 verses of Daniel 7. That's enough. Woo, we got enough to talk about. Daniel 7 keeps talking and thinking and reflecting on the dream, but we might tap into that just a little bit, but we got enough to talk about. If you're like me and you find writing in your Bible helpful, I would just mark up 16, 17, and 18. You know, underline it, bracket it, put a star by it, something. Because those verses are really helpful for understanding Daniel 7. These verses are like key. The Bible, the imagery of the Bible, even the wildest imagery of the Bible, isn't a free-for-all. It's not like it can just mean anything. It's not like we can say, oh, the second beast, he looked like a bear, and he had ribs in his teeth. Maybe that reminds me of a bear that likes to eat a lot. Maybe that's Yogi Bear. You know, like, that's a stupid example. But you know what I mean. It's like, this imagery isn't a free-for-all. Even the wildest imagery in the Bible, and 16, 17, and 18 ground us in what this is about. This dream is about kings and kingdoms. That's what this dream is about. It's about kings and kingdoms. One kingdom, like beasts rising out of the sea, one kingdom rising after the last kingdom, and more kingdoms following after that. The world full of different kingdoms, full of different governments, full of different empires. One after the next, after the next. That's almost like the history of the world, isn't it? That's almost like the history of the world. You know, empire after empire, government after government. History marches on and on. It's like this endless line of kingdoms trying to rule the world, trying to rule the world in every way we can think of, like through power, through economics, through intervention in the Middle East, through military might, through the names, they come and they go. Cairo ruled the world, and then Athens. Rome was big, and Constantinople at one point. Berlin, Moscow, London, Washington. They come, they go, and then eventually, a new kind of kingdom shows up. a new kind of kingdom arrives. A kingdom, verse 9, a kingdom from God himself, from the Ancient of Days. A kingdom that burns away, burns, fire, burns away all evil and wickedness and pride and brings about, verse 14, brings about a new kind of world order, a new kind of government, a new kind of reality on the in the world that will never be destroyed. An everlasting kingdom. And so let's reflect, let's go back through this dream just a little bit. This is our plan of action for the next few minutes. We're just going to go back through this dream, reflect on it a little bit. We're going to make two reflections towards the end, and then we're going to come to the table. Does that sound okay? And somewhere in the midst of all this, I hope we can glimpse coming to judge the living and the dead as being good news. Verse 2. This dream begins with swirling water. Oh man, and this might be helpful as we're talking through this to just kind of visualize all this. This is a very visual kind of passage. It begins with swirling water. In fact, it's a giant sea. Imagine, I'm going to take off my sandals. Imagine the last time you were at the beach. When was the last time you were at the beach and you were just standing there, the sand between your toes, and you're looking out at the ocean, at the waves lapping before you, but then you look and it's just expansive. It's just, oh man, you can't even fathom how big this is. In the ancient world, before you have Google Maps, before you kind of like know how big the ocean is, which we still can't even grasp how big it is, if there were ever a place in the world that was going to be opposed to God, that was going to be opposed to like the goodness and the order of God, a place where life just couldn't exist, it would be the untamable, seemingly unending chaos of the ocean, of the sea. That would be the place. So, like, water is like, oh, man. And now, all of a sudden, beasts, horrible, monstrous beasts, no takers on Disney, oh well, are coming out of this chaos, out of this realm where things are just disordered and it's expansive. Beasts are coming out of this sea. And each of these beasts, which are kings, kingdoms, that's what these things are, it's a dream, it's psychedelic, they're coming out of the sea. And each of these beasts, they really are beasts. They're monstrous. It's like some sort of grotesque kindergarten project, you know, like make your own furry Frankenstein sort of day, you know, like you've spread a bunch of animal parts out on a table and like go to town, kids, you know, heads, legs, wings, skin, fur, you know, teeth, whatever you want. Just go for it. Build your own animal. I call this one Larry the Ligle. Ligle? Yes, a ligle. It's kind of like a lion, and it's kind of like an eagle. I call it a ligle. You know, that's really neat. And look, his wings come off, too. Oh, and he stands up like a human being because he's got a person's brain. Well, all right. That's very good, Susie. That's fine work there, honey. That's the first beast. Not quite the sort of stuff that you find in a petting zoo. In fact, it's not quite the sort of stuff that you find in any zoo, in anywhere in nature. If you had the Book of Leviticus traveling with you as your traveling companion, the Book of Leviticus would take one look at poor Larry the Ligle and would say that's unnatural. That is a mixture of things that shouldn't be. That's unclean. That is nothing like what God had in mind. And yet that's what every single one of these beasts is. They're just totally unnatural. That's what every sort of one of these kingdoms is. It's rising up out of chaos. And it's nothing like what God had in mind. And these beasts are the ones ruling the world. And they're awful. And verse 7, the fourth one is the worst, like the absolute worst. And this one's got lots of horns. Lots of 10 horns. Did you guys hear that? This one's really strong is that what that means. That's what horns symbolize in ancient apocalyptic literature, which is what Daniel is. But we don't even need to go to ancient apocalyptic literature. That's what horns symbolize even in a zoo. Like, you go to the zoo and you look at something and you're like, that's a strong animal. Look at the size of the horn on that thing. You go to the rhino pen. Go to the rhino pen and you look at the rhinos hanging out. You look at their great big horns. And then you go to the hippo pool. You move a little bit. I don't know where, Joy knows the zoo, but wherever it is. The hippo pool, and you see those hippos just kind of floating there with their lack of horns and their blubber, you know. Who are you going to choose in a fight? Who are you going to choose in a fight? I got a sneaking suspicion it's going to be the guy with the sword coming out of his head. You know, that's the guy I'm going to pick in the fight. Even though hippos are really dangerous, I don't know who would. There's actually a website that I found that's devoted to who would win in a fight. It's like a big question. Hippos are right. Anyway, I didn't know that when I. The point is, horns just look strong. Like, you see a horn and you're like, man, that's strong looking. And this fourth monster has got 10 of them. 10 horns. And then another horn, a little one, is, verse 8, talking. This horn is talk. This is a strange dream. This is a strange dream. Thankfully, we get told later that, these 10 horns, verse 27, if you want to mark it. Verse 27, we find out that these 10 horns are actually 10 kings. And so that little boasting horn, he's actually a little boasting king. And verse 27 goes on to say that this little king, he's abusing people. He's hurting people. He's opposing the people of God. Verse 21 says that he's waging war against the people of God, and he is defeating them, is what it says. The point is, this is a really strong, really nasty, really grueling thing that's happening, and it's really hurting people. Things are not as they should be. It's darkness and dangerous and absolute chaos. But then God appears. Then God appears. The good news is about God, by the way. The good news is about God. God appears. The Ancient of Days appears, at verse 9. The one who's above all, who's before all, who's behind all, who's above all, he appears and he passes judgment. That's what he does. God appears and he passes judgment. He makes things right. The final beast, the worst beast, oh, with his 10 horns and his unimaginable strength and that tiny little horn, that boasting little king who's hurting people. Totally, verse 11, totally destroyed. The forces of evil are plunged into a river of fire that flows from the throne of the Ancient of Days. They're cast into the brilliant, purifying, melting presence of God himself. His very throne is on fire, verse 9. And in the very presence of God, oh, the very presence of God burns away all evil. It banishes all shadows. And it establishes a new kingdom, a new world order, an entirely new way of living on planet Earth. And did you notice as we went through the dream, as we read it, did you notice what that last kingdom is, that everlasting kingdom? Did you notice what it's symbolized as? Did you notice? Yeah, it's verse 13. I'll give you a hint. It's not unclean. It's not unnatural. It's not a monster. In fact, it's not even an animal. It's one like a son of man. It's a new way of living on planet Earth, and it's a kingdom it's not a beast, it's not a monster, it's a human being. It's a human being. Breathe this in for just a second. Because this dream just went from nightmare to gospel. This dream just went from nightmare to gospel. The world has been dominated by the inhumane, by the inhuman, by all kinds of savagery, by all kinds of barbarism, by crushing and trampling and devouring and terror. Things aren't as they should be. They aren't as God intended for them to be. The beasts have been ruling the world. That's nowhere close to Genesis 1. The world wasn't meant to be ruled by animals. The world was supposed to be ruled by human beings, by the very image of God himself, by people who are reflecting the image of God into the world, who are extending the dancing delight of the Trinity throughout all of creation. And now, in verse 13, with the coming of one who is like a son of man, shifted from nightmare to gospel. With the coming of one like a son of man, things are finally the way that they're supposed to be. Shadows have been banished. The king is finally human, and dancing now fills the land. God has judged the world, and it's good news. There are a lot of passages that we could gravitate to in the New Testament to help us grapple with God judging the world that we could have been looking at today. We could look at certain parables in the Gospels. We could look at the end of 1 Thessalonians, the end of 1 Corinthians, the end of 2 Peter. We could be looking at the middle part of Romans. We could be looking at certain parts of Revelation. I'm sure that at some point we can look at those passages. That's fine. But today we're looking at Daniel for two reasons. These are the two reasons that I wanted to gravitate to Daniel today. First, I think Daniel chapter 7 keeps us humble. It keeps us humble while we're thinking about the future. We don't get arrogant reading Daniel 7. This is a really hard bit of scripture for us to read. We like neat and polished interpretations of scripture, don't we? We want the Bible to like give a clear forecast for history, you know? Like Denver's weather guys can't get the... Well, they can right now. It seems like they can get the weather right. They can just say, hey, it's probably going to rain today. And, you know, that's probably right. But we want the Bible to give a clear, accurate forecast of all of history. We want tomorrow's news today in a very clear format in the Bible so that we can put up colorful charts and timelines of future events and know exactly what's going to happen. But instead of that, we get passages like this. We get passages like this. We want details. God gives us dreams. He gives us a dream, you know, that you can't nail down. And as we get, even with the help that we get later on in this chapter, it's impossible for us to nail down the details of this dream. It's impossible for us to do this. If you start, I mean, the general shape of it is clear enough, especially that the nightmare ends. But when we try to get close, when we try to start like nailing down details, it's like we're getting close to like a television, an old tube set television or something, and everything's just getting real grainy and pixelated and stuff. We just can't, it just gets all fuzzy. I don't think that's just true of Daniel chapter 7. I think that's true of the New Testament too, because the New Testament is tapping into the tradition of the Old Testament, into this chapter of Daniel. We can get general shapes from like the sheep and the goats when Jesus tells us about sheep and goats. We can get a general shape from that. From Paul's correspondence, we can get a general shape about the future. From John's visions on the Isle of Patmos at the end of the Bible, we can get a general shape that God is going to restore the world, that God's going to finally destroy evil, that God is going to rescue anyone and everyone who is willing to become part of his people. But we can't say much more than that. That's really about the extent of what we can say, best I can tell. And we certainly can't say when this is going to happen. From what we can tell, there's just a general shape to let us know that it's going to happen. And that should keep us humble when we're talking about judging the living and the dead, future things, that sort of thing. But Daniel 7 also keeps us hopeful. It keeps us hope. That's why something like Daniel 7 is written. That's why the book of Revelation is written, by the way, too. That's why anytime people start writing like this, it is to give people hope. There's a general shape, and it is going to happen. The day is going to come. That's exactly the point of this dream. That's the point the entire biblical witness is making when it talks about the future. When the biblical writers, like when they talk like this, when they give a general shape of the future and kind of dreamlike imagery, they are not encrypting it with a certain algorithm, you know, a certain code, in hopes that one day someone's finally going to crack the code and figure out, oh, exactly what all of this means. That's not the reason. The reason that they're writing this is God is giving us the general shape of the future so that we can find hope in the present. So that right now in our lives, we can find hope. Because if the human race has no destiny, if there's no higher plan, if we're not a part of any larger story, then why does the present matter at all? Why do we care? How can I find hope in the present? How can I keep going? How can I keep going tomorrow how can I face the suffering of today or the uncertainty of tomorrow if really all our bodies are just going to start falling apart and everyone that we ever know is going to die? And that's it. Why would we work for justice in the future or in the present? Why would we drill wells in Africa and make sure that people have clean water to drink? Why would we try to alleviate hunger? Why would we try to cure diseases if the human race is one day inevitably going to be extinct? Either the sun burns out and we all freeze, or the universe keeps expanding and we all freeze, or it collapses back in on itself. What? Why would we work for anything in the present if the future isn't certain? Why do justice or hunger or sickness matter right now? What's the point? What's the point of any of it? For 2,000 years, the church has said that the reason not only anything matters, the reason everything matters is because the world has a judge. Because the world has a judge, somebody who is going to set things right. One like a son of man will eventually set the world right, will eventually set history right, will eventually set the past even right. Oh, those mistakes, oh, my regret. He's going to set our lives right. By the way, son of man is Jesus' favorite title for himself. Just to let you know, that's his favorite title. Other people call him all kinds of things, rabbi, messiah, you know, Christ, whatever, son of God even. They'll call him son of God. It's a kingly, royal title coming from Psalm 2. But when Jesus talks about himself, he calls himself son of man. I'm the son of man. You know, that's his favorite, his most frequent title for himself. That Jesus knew this wacky dream. He knew this wacky dream. And he says, yeah, I'm that guy. I'm that guy. I'm the human one. I'm the son of man. I'm the one who's going to set things right one day. That's how you can go on. That's why you should care. That's how you can hope. Because I've experienced evil and death. And I have conquered evil and death. And one day I am going to banish evil and death. The good news is about God. The good news is about God. That God has given us a judge. He's given us a judge who will banish the nightmare and who announces good news. And as we begin to believe this good news. Oh, if we can just believe it for just even a second. Oh, if we can glimpse it, breathe it in. Oh, for just a second. That God is going to judge the living and the dead and believe the resurrection of the body and the life everlasting. Suddenly the future starts to give us hope in the present. starts to give us hope in the present. The future isn't something to fear. The future isn't full of chaos and monsters and death. The future is full of the Son of Man. The future is full of the Son of Man, the Son of Man who has all power and glory and authority and who knows what it's like. The future is a place where Jesus already is, and he is lovingly, relentlessly bringing us there too. The future isn't something you have to make. It's not something you're responsible for. It's not something you have to earn. It's not something you have to build. The future is something that God freely gives. Because that's what God is like. This table is the place in the present moment, in just a second, like it's coming right now. This table, when we come to it, is the place in the present where we begin to trust the Son of Man. Where we begin to trust the Son of Man. I mean, after all, if he's going to banish, we have to trust him, because if he banishes every shadow, every bit of evil from the world, why am I not being banished too? Why wouldn't I contribute to this? Why wouldn't I be judged for this? I know my heart. I know my actions. I'm full of darkness. This table is the place where we come to trust the judge, where we come to trust the Son of Man, where we approach the fiery presence of God and invite him to not just burn away the monsters of this world, but invite him to burn away the monster within us. This table's the place where we come to trust, mercy of mercy, that the judge has been judged in our place. The judge has been judged in our place, and so we can trust him with our future. This table is the place where we come to find the future freely given to us in bread and juice. It's the place where we can learn to receive the future, where we can God's giving a good future, and so because God is giving a good future, I can find faith and hope and love in the present. This is the place where we hear that the Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me." And Paul says, whenever we eat this bread and drink this cup, we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Until he comes. Our table is an open table. It's open to all who are hungry and thirsty for real and lasting life. Open to all who believe the judge when he says, "My body is for you." It's for you. In just a moment, you'll be invited to come down the center aisle to receive a bit of bread, to dip it in the cup, and then return to your seats along the side aisles. As you come this morning, may you trust that the world's darkness will be banished by the light of Easter. May you trust that the resurrected one is drawing even you into his future. May you believe the good news about the coming judgment.